Our second case this morning is United States against Williams. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, there are two issues before the court today. Whether the appellant is entitled to additional confinement credit under RCN 305K, and whether appellant is entitled to additional confinement credit for violations of Article 13 UCMJ. In this case, the military judge erred when he found violations of AFY 31205 and failed to find an abuse of discretion warranting confinement credit under RCN 305K. As this court held in Adcock, a military judge should consider the violations of service regulations as a basis for additional pretrial confinement credit under RCM 305K when such a regulation reflects a longstanding concern for the prevention of pretrial punishment and the protection of service members' rights. In this case, confinement officials knowingly and deliberately violated the provisions of AFI 31205, paragraph 8 specifically, service regulations which are designed to protect the rights of service members by denying appellant the medical care required when confinement officials chose to place an individual on such restrictive confinement. The cell size in this case, which was different than the maximum custody, was a 5 foot 10 inch by 8 by 8, where the appellant is 6 foot 3.
Is your focus on what size the cell was, or on whether or not he had a doctor evaluating him every 24 hours for the appropriateness of continued suicide watch?
The focus, Your Honor, is on the fact that he was denied mental health care, medical health care, every 24 hours as required by the regulations.
Does the regulation really require that? Isn't the regulation cast in substantially vaguer terms? It requires something, but it does not require, it does not seem to require that a physician visit him every 24 hours.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. The regulation is a mandatory regulation. The Secretary of the
I'm not denying that. I'm saying what is it mandatory about? What does it require?
When, under paragraph 8.1, confinement officials elect to place an appellant into suicide watch in a suicide cell, they are required, they have additional requirements to safeguard the protections that this service member is entitled to. So it's mandatory when there are such restrictions to allow the service member to have some of those rights which are guaranteed.
You haven't answered my question. What does the reg require? Does it require that a physician meet him every day? I agree it can be read that way.
Yes, Your Honor.
But
that a medical authority will review the appropriateness of continued suicide watch at minimum every 24 hours. So in this context, what does medical authority mean?
We are in this
and what does review mean? Can you review remotely? Can you review? You follow? So you have to dissect medical authority and appropriateness in review.
Well, perhaps one could review remotely, but that didn't even occur in this case. There were 5 times that mental health authorities reviewed the status over a 274 time period that the appellant was in suicide watch. So the medical authorities that placed the appellant in the suicide watch with these restrictions never came back to review. There was one of those 5 instances where it was a phone consultation between a Dr. Barker and the appellant, and that seems to satisfy a review.
Didn't the appellant refuse to be reviewed? Didn't the appellant basically say, get out of here, I don't want you?
There was one instant when the provider Malazzo came and he was asleep and he said he did not want care. Initially, when the mental health provider, Major Leckie, came to the confinement facility, he did not want to answer questions about the potential charges, not necessarily suicidal ideations, but I would say that he did not cooperate. with necessarily the care that was to be provided at that time, but that does not alleviate mental health providers or confinement officials from coming back and saying, as required, every 24 hours, is this individual still suicidal? Does he have ideation? Should he remain in these restrictive?
Well, if you won't talk to him, how are they supposed to find that out?
Your Honor, that's a good point. However, we don't know that he's not going to talk to him every single time. He did, in fact, talk to the second provider on two occasions, asking about having the suicide watch restrictions lifted. So the fact that a mental health provider says that he's uncooperative does not necessarily make it so, when the regulation requires, if you put an appellant on this strict restrictions, then you're required to go in and check on that individual.
Are people on suicide watch generally cooperative, uncooperative, or some of both? And perhaps you're not a medical authority, so I don't know if that's a reasonable question, but
it appears that they can be cooperative at some times, uncooperative at other times, and certainly that's an indication as to why a mental health provider might be or should be required to do the 24-hour check.
Now, the government says that, and I believe you agree, that this the appellant was visited three times a week by someone who was in the business of medical something. Is that fair to say so far?
That's fair to say.
Who was it and what were they doing and why aren't they a medical authority?
Nurse practitioners, Your Honor, who are coming in to evaluate whether or not the...
nurse practitioners is the came three times a week.
And there may have been some doctors in there as well. I'm not sure. The record is not clear.
Why aren't nurse practitioners medical authorities for the purposes of the regulation?
They would be working at the discretion of the doctor to go in and treat the or look at the appellant. However, they are not medical professionals in this sense of the word because they are not authorized to remove the individual, the appellant, from a suicide watch. Likewise, neither is the other provider, Dr. Barker or Dr. Malazzo. So the only time that Dr. Leckie, the major who made the recommendation for the suicide watch, he only saw the appellant two times. So it was the other three times for a total of five. He was seen by other providers, mental health providers, who could not release him from the suicide watch. And in addition, the other medical providers, nurse practitioners, did not have the authority to remove him from the suicide watch. So it's an empty requirement if it's only a medical authority that has to come in and not the mental health provider who actually placed the appellant on the suicide watch.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to 305K for a moment, if we could. In ADCOC, what we were talking about there were service regulations that were designed to protect the rights of presumptively innocent service members. And in that particular case, we were dealing with a situation where when service members were placed, pretrial confinees were placed in civilian institutions, there was no delineation between themselves and individuals who were convicted as far as uniforms were concerned. In this case, we have a regulation that addresses individuals on suicide watch. And it appears to me that it addresses anybody who is on suicide watch. It doesn't specifically say pretrial detainees who are on suicide watch or convicted prisoners who are on suicide watch. So where do you get your argument from in light of ADCOC, it looks to me like this regulation was not designed to protect pretrial detainees. It was designed to protect anybody who is in a suicide watch status.
Your Honor, the mandatory regulations that oversee the confinement officials, the regulation is designed to protect the service members' rights. Now, certainly there's a presumption of innocence at any time an individual is placed in pretrial confinement. They have not been convicted at that point.
But this regulation would apply equally to a person who has been convicted and who has been placed on suicide watch.
Yes. It appears that it would, but certainly when you look at the pretrial punishment portion of it and what 305K or 305 generally when you read 305K with 304, the appellant would also be entitled to additional credit in if there was an abuse of discretion by confinement officials.
But it seems to me that language in Adcock was designed to limit that, to place some types of limitation on it, rather than saying any regulation in the world that's been violated, you can come in and ask for additional credit. It seems to me that Adcock said if it is a regulation that was designed to protect your rights as an individual who is presumed innocent.
Adcock does have a narrow holding dealing with the commingling of pretrial and post-trial confinees. However, the presumption of innocence is certainly a larger certainly encompasses larger than just a commingling of pretrial and post-trials. Anytime an individual's rights are, their liberty rights are at stake, 305 with 304 should serve as a means for additional confinement credit when there is an abuse of discretion or unusually harsh circumstances.
Counsel, below they didn't contest the fact that pretrial confinement was authorized, right?
That's correct.
And I guess I'm having a little bit of tricks, even as an initial matter. I mean, in this case, my understanding is that the military judge on the motion considered all these things, found that indeed that the government had not followed the Air Force instruction, and awarded pretrial confinement credit. So where is his abuse of discretion?
The abuse of discretion, Your Honor,
is that he didn't give you as much confinement credit as you wanted?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And where in Adcock does it say that it's an abuse of discretion if they don't give you everything you ask for?
Your Honor, it's certainly not that.
Because, I mean, he took into account all the circumstances, and those are in his findings of fact and conclusions of law. And so what precisely do you point to that is an abuse of discretion in this case?
Your Honor, could you just repeat the first part of that?
How did the military judge abuse his discretion if, in fact, when the day was done, he did give credit?
In that case, Your Honor, in this case, he did not even consider it under 305K analysis, although defense raised it in their motion for appropriate relief. He did consider it under Article 13, an intent to punish, or whether the conditions were more onerous than...
Well, isn't that exactly what he's supposed to do? 305 goes to placing someone, the act of placing someone, as I said in Adcock, into pretrial. 13 deals with the conditions of confinement. He dealt with 13. He gave him 188 days. End of story. Where's the abuse of discretion?
Why don't you address the first half, whatever occurred before August 26th?
I would address those in two ways, Your Honor. First is a violation of Article 13 UCMJ, but also that plays into the second argument, or the first argument, that would be entitled to the credit for the entire period of 1 June 2004 until 2 March 2005. So that...
Under Article 13?
The 86 days from June 2004 to 25 August 04 would be the additional Article 13 credit, and then we're asking for additional confinement credit under Article 3, under RCM 305K for 270 days, the entire period from 1 June 2004 until 2 March, the date of trial, 2004.
And what is the basis for the 305 request?
That there was an abuse of discretion by the confinement officials, that the military judge at the trial level did not address that, and there were unusually harsh circumstances.
An abuse of discretion in what? Putting him in there in the first place? I thought they didn't raise that issue at trial.
They did not. They did not raise
it. Well, then why isn't it waived?
Well, this court under Adcock found that the abuse of discretion applied to a military review, a review by a military or magistrate not just over the placing into confinement and reviewing whether or not the individual should stay in confinement. So under Adcock, the abuse of discretion language permits a military judge to award an additional credit based on the conduct by confinement officials that amounts to abuse of discretion.
Well, if the issue of the legality of putting him in there in the first place wasn't raised at trial, and you said it wasn't, then why isn't it waived, or forfeited, rather?
Why isn't it waived?
Why isn't it forfeited?
It was
why isn't the issue forfeited?
It was raised at trial. It is unlike this court's decision in the United States versus Chaffa.
It was raised at trial.
Illegal pretrial confinement, not to be placed in confinement.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, the placement.
I'm confused. Are you seeking credit because he was placed on suicide watch or because he was not reviewed every 24 hours in some manner?
Or both?
We're requesting for violations of the AFI 31205 for failing of the confinement officials to review the medical status of the appellant every 24 hours as required by the mandatory regulation by Secretary
of Defense. But isn't that precisely what the military judge based his determination that any credit was due on? And didn't you, at Joint Appendix Record 353, in the argument section of the motion, didn't the defense say the defense is not arguing that Staff Sergeant Williams should not have been placed in maximum custody after escaping confinement? So you weren't challenging the fact that he was placed in pretrial confinement.
That's fair.
So we're going back to my initial question, what was the abuse of discretion other than you're not satisfied with the amount of credit that the military judge decided to give after considering all the circumstances?
I see that my time has expired.
You can answer the question.
Thank you. The unusually harsh conditions of the no mental health care, basically, five visits over the 272 days in conjunction with the abuse of discretion in that there's a mandatory regulation that requires the confinement officials to reevaluate this individual on a 24-hour basis to determine whether they should be on these strict restrictions. I would also, in the military judge's rulings, we do not dispute any of the findings of fact. However, the judge makes a decision to include in his discussion a number of paragraphs that we certainly do oppose, and their legal conclusions, drawing inferences and implications, and not subject to any clearly erroneous standard, should be reviewed de novo.
Counsel, just a question about the meaning of 305K. 305K talks about remedy of noncompliance for violations of F, H, I, and J. And you can get one day credit for those violations. Then it says the military judge may order additional credit for each day of pretrial confinement that involves an abuse of discretion or unusually harsh circumstances. Now, does that abuse of discretion mean any violation of any regulation, or does it mean a violation of a regulation that implicates subsections F, H, I, or J? In other words, is the abuse of discretion tied to the underlying remedy hook in the rule, or does it have some independent existence?
Well, when you pair that with 304 and the fact that pretrial punishment is not permitted, and then read that 305 is the only way to get a remedy for violations of pretrial confinement, the analysis remains the same in terms of knowing and deliberate or unusually harsh, but should be entitled to a review where a liberty interest is at stake. And in this case, it certainly is, in that the appellant is in a confinement facility more strenuous than a maximum custody situation. And he remains for 274 days without the type of care that he's entitled to.
But would that constitute a violation of F, H, I, or J at some point?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good May it please the Court, I'm Captain Matt Osborne, and I, along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, represent the United States in this matter. The appellant in this case is not entitled to any additional credit under RCM 305K or any more additional credit than what has already been given to him by the military judge at trial under Article 13 UCMJ. The confinement officials and the medical personnel in this case did not abuse their discretion in treating appellant while he was in pretrial confinement, nor did the military judge or the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals abuse their discretion in finding that no such abuse took place. But before even getting to that abuse of discretion standard for the service regulation, the government believes it's important to address two factors that we believe will get this court to where you don't even have to address the abuse of discretion standard. The first is the appellant's forfeiture under 305, for not bringing up 305K in his pretrial, in his trial motion. Now, while RCM 305K is mentioned, is cited in the law section of his motion at trial, the appellant did not ask for relief under 305K in his motion.
He asked for relief. So in your view, if you look at paragraph 17, it says, the failure to comply with the AFI by not evaluating Staff Sergeant Williams on a daily basis to determine if his remaining on suicide watch was appropriate does not raise the issue because he didn't deliver the punchline, which was, and therefore give me relief.
That's correct, Your Honor. He only requested relief under Article 13. He did not.
So this is a sort of a pleadings failure, cited the wrong rule.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the rule was certainly there, and it was certainly there to be cited. However, the appellant only asked for credit under Article 13.
What about paragraph 12? RCM 305K states in part the military judge may order additional credit for each day, blah, blah, blah.
Yes,
why isn't that putting the issue before the judge?
The government's opinion is there. He's not putting the issue of requesting 305K credit on its own by citing that. He's citing that because, as this court ruled in U.S. v. Crawford, the way you get Article 13 credit is through 305K. So that is why he's tying that in. He never asked specifically for 305K credit standing alone. And that's why we make that forfeiture argument.
Well, what did the military judge do here? I mean, did he award the credit one for one under Article 13 or maybe unknowingly under 305K? Because when you read what he said for the period 26 August to the present, it's necessary for the failure of the confinement officials to follow Air Force instructions relating to maintaining a detainee in suicide watch status. So he's referring back to the regulation.
Right.
So what did he do?
Right. And granted, this case is pre-ADCOC. We would surmise that if this was a post-ADCOC case, he would probably grant it under 305K instead of just the Article 13, because that's basically what he did, is you're going to get credit for these violations.
Now, and what was the triggering event as of August 26th that made this change?
The triggering event then is when the appellant's mental health provider, Dr. Leckie, sent a memo to the confinement official saying that suicide watch is no longer recommended. However, I'll caveat that by him saying the reason it's not recommended is because he's being uncooperative and I really just can't get a read one way or the other. However, you know, for purposes of this, we're going to take him off of suicide.
So that's what he's referring to in his order that or in the military judge when he says Air Force instruction relating to maintaining a detainee in suicide watch status.
That's correct.
And what provision then in that regulation is he referring to?
In terms of?
Well, the judge is referencing back to the Air Force instruction.
Correct.
And the focus of this inquiry or this case so far, I guess what I'm looking for is a specific provision in the instruction that the military judge is talking about here.
I think he was referencing towards 8.10. However, his point was, up until that point, 26 August, the confinement officials were getting what they needed to know from the mental health providers to keep him in the, quote, suicide watch confinement status. And that after 26 August, the confinement officials didn't know or were not given enough information to keep those conditions that you get under the suicide watch in place.
It seems to me that on 26 August, the only thing that changed was that Dr. Leakey made the recommendation that his status be changed, and the confinement officials didn't do that.
That's correct. Although I will say some of the confinement conditions did change. Immediately after that, instead of wearing the gown, he began wearing shorts and T-shirts. He certainly began having access to CDs and books and that type of thing, to the point where he's watching the Super Bowl in January.
But he got confinement credit for those days.
He did.
Okay. So what I'm trying to figure out is what distinguishes that, if we're talking about the 24-hour checkup for appropriateness, that occurred all the way through.
Correct. What distinguishes the difference is that at that point, the medical provider is saying, hey, don't believe suicide watch is necessary anymore. If you follow the progression of the medical records and the memos, I mean, these confinement officials and certainly the mental health providers are trying to do the best they can in terms of getting his getting a state for him to be in.
So that's the triggering event. It's the leaky recommendation that wasn't followed, which I guess under the way we can construe this is that becomes an Article 13 violation for conditions more onerous than are necessary.
That is correct, Your Honor.
How did the government comply with the relevant AFI paragraph during the period from 1 June to August 25?
Did they comply?
Did they comply?
I would say for the most part, yes, they did.
Your answer is for the most part.
Well, I would say they did, because it says a medical authority will review the appropriateness of continued suicide watch at a minimum every 24 hours after the initiation of the certification.
Okay, so in this case, what medical authority reviewed the appropriateness of continued suicide watch every 24 hours, and how is that documented?
Well, we have, as was attached in the joint appendix, we've got over 100 pages of medical records, of evaluations, of notes that the doctors took during that time. We also have, 2 to 3 times a week, we have the medical.
I'm asking you, who was the medical authority who did this every 24 hours? Does the record reflect that?
No, Your Honor.
Is the government's position that that occurred, or that the government did close enough and that's sufficient under the mandatory instruction from the Secretary of the Air Force?
Right. It's the government's position is that considering the appellant's level of uncooperativeness, his past actions, and things of that nature.
So if you have someone on suicide watch who's not cooperating, then it's not necessary to comply with Air Force instructions.
That is not our position at all.
But it sounds like it is. If you're uncooperative, therefore, you don't need to check on them every 24 hours?
Our position is that based on his uncooperativeness, and that's the reason for which they
right, and is it the government's position that therefore that is compliance or that's not compliance, but the appellant loses for a different reason? If that's compliance, is it or is it not compliance?
If the question is, was his case reviewed every 24 hours, the record would appear to say that it does not.
And is it the government's view then that the government complied with the regulation or did not?
No, they did not.
So it's the government's view that the regulation bears the interpretation that the appellant is putting on.
Not necessarily to the level that they are talking about.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the appellant. What does the regulation require?
The regulation says that a medical authority will review every 24 hours.
And what does that mean?
In the government's opinion, it's not necessarily physically reviewing our meeting with the appellant. It's reviewing his records. It's getting recommendations from other people. Okay. It's, all the things that the government did in this case.
So wait, you just told me that they did not comply with the regulation. Did they or did they not? I understand you can interpret it different ways.
Right.
Making your best interpretation in your view.
Sure. My point to you, Your Honor, is that the evidence of record does not have on 24 May I did this, on 25 May I did this, on 26 May I
right.
did that.
But
if that's what this regulation is.
Did they or did they not comply with the regulation, however you interpret it, government, in this case?
No, they did not.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your candor, too. That's important in arguing these cases.
My related question is when the military judge made his findings of fact and conclusions of law on this question, you're not suggesting that he was wrong when he said that the confinement officials didn't do what the Air Force instruction said that they should do, but that he also considered all the other circumstances that you're talking about?
That is exactly correct. That is exactly correct.
So what is your position as to whether the military judge did or did not err in declining to give all the credit that the defendant asked for?
Why? The military judge certainly did not err. The first point being that the provision...
Or discretion, I guess.
Correct, Your Honor. The first point is that the provision in question was not the type of service regulation provision that this court foresaw in its limited holding in ADCOC. As was noted earlier, the point in ADCOC was where the regulations reflect a long-standing concern for prevention of pretrial punishment, and in ADCOC it was given because those regulations were clearly intended to safeguard the accused service member's rights to treatment consistent with a presumption of innocence, and later noted that to protect the rights of presumptively innocent service members. And of course, in ADCOC, we're talking about commingling of pre- and post-trial inmates. We're talking about pre- and post-trial inmates wearing the same uniform. Here, we're talking about a provision that deals with medical treatment and safety of the accused, of the appellant, and also pretty much for the confinement officials as well. The regulation states that the confinement officer develops procedures to ensure the safety of suicidal inmates. And it's important to note that it doesn't say suicidal pretrial inmates or suicidal post-trial inmates. It says suicidal inmates. So here the medical treatment, the safety precautions are there for both pre- and post-trial inmates, so there's certainly nothing, it has nothing to do with a presumption of innocence or treating confinees as innocent individuals. It certainly does reflect a long-standing concern for prevention of pretrial punishment. So what the appellant is trying to do here is pull out...
So are there no circumstances under which a generally applicable regulation as to medical treatment, food, would be used in a prison setting where it might not implicate the purposes of either Article 13 or Rule 305?
Well, certainly Article 13 is a different set of circumstances than under, for violation of service regulations. I mean, if medical treatment's being withheld or food's being withheld for the purpose of, for punishment's sake, then we've got an Article 13 issue. If it's being withheld based on, onerous conditions that don't have a legitimate government purpose, then we're looking at an Article 13 violation. But if we're simply looking at it for under 305K alone, based on the violation of a service regulation, that is not what this court held in ADCOC.
Well, what does ADCOC stand for if it doesn't stand for a proposition that you look to the underlying values of Article 13 in terms of why 305 exists? Is that not related, or is that completely unrelated in the government's view?
The government would view that these as being unrelated.
Okay.
If it's an Article 13 violation, then that's a different standard than what this court held in ADCOC, which would warrant additional credit under 305K alone. However, even if we got to, even if this court were to find that this service...
So in your view, if you don't have an Article 13 violation when a regulation violation doesn't equate to an Article 13 violation, what particularly about a regulation violation would make it a 305 violation? What's the specifics that the government would have us look at there in light of ADCOC?
The specifics would be what this court held in ADCOC, which is those that are specifically designed to treat pretrial confinees in a manner that recognizes the presumption of innocence. So as I said before, the commingling, the uniform wear, things of that nature in terms of the housing and treatment between pretrial and post-trial confinement.
So there's no circumstances under which a suicide watch could be administered that would invoke 305 considerations?
Not outside of Article 13. However, even if this court were to say that this provision fell under that that standard of ad hoc. The record certainly shows that the military judge and the confinement officials, for that matter, did not abuse their discretion in their treatment of the appellant. The main evidence appellant uses to show this supposed abuse of discretion is the testimony of a defense expert who, as the record shows, really had no idea about the appellant's background, the appellant's history, and everything that the appellant had gone through. She was stating that the standard of care of Dr. Lecky, the government mental health provider, was wrong. However, she certainly didn't have the background and knowledge of everything that had gone on with the appellant. For instance, she had no idea about the false claims the appellant had made against a variety of confinement officials.
You're attacking the appellant's expert. Please explain why failure to comply with the regulation is not an abuse of discretion. I think you have an argument, but you need to make it without just saying that their expert stunk.
Well, I would say that it's the appellant's duty, it's their burden to show this. It's their burden to show it was an abuse of discretion. And the way in which they did that was this expert's testimony to say how awful, you know, supposedly this standard of care was for this government doctor. And it's first, it's important to note, you know, the basis for which this defense expert was giving her opinion, and it was based on you know, the lack of full knowledge. However, you know, we've also got to look at who exactly, you know, these government officials were dealing with. I mean, we've got an appellant who's had multiple suicide ideations, who told a girlfriend about how he, you know, foresaw himself being killed and then set himself up on two instances for that to happen, when he kidnapped his girlfriend and then he escaped from confinement. This confining, as the Air Force Court and the military judge also show, also found, he was quite uncooperative at times.
Well, now, let's talk about that. I mean, people that are in suicide watches are often going to have some psychological issues. And oftentimes, I would imagine, they're not going to be cooperative. How in the world does that excuse the government from following a regulation that is designed to protect their security, the individual's security?
I mean, their uncooperativeness?
How does that excuse them? I mean, you keep raising the uncooperativeness as if it is somehow an excuse for the government not following the instruction.
Well, it's not an excuse in and of itself. It's something to look at in the totality of the circumstances.
And why? Why? I mean, just because an individual is in a suicide watch and they're uncooperative, does that mean that the government is no longer required to give this care to them?
Not at all. I mean, they're certainly entitled to the care. However, when it's refused, I mean, that's certainly something to take into consideration. I mean, when a doctor shows up who is wanting to treat the appellant and want to...
Well, no, I think the doctors that were coming in there weren't treating him. In fact, the one doctor said they couldn't treat him. They were just there for, you know, analysis.
Well, they're there for analysis to then take back to the overall doctor to then determine whether or not suicide watch is still needed. So when he gets there and he's turned away by the appellant, I think that's certainly something that this court needs to take into account. He certainly, you know...
So because of their psychological condition, the fact that the government deems that they are uncooperative when they come in to visit them means that the government need not follow the regulations that are designed to protect that individual.
That is not what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm getting.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that's something that needs to be taken into consideration with the overall treatment and review of the appellant's case.
Well, I mean, it's a diagnostic notation, but it certainly is not a legal notation. I mean, I don't know, understand how that would have legal consequence.
The point being, if they would have shown up at his doorstep every day from May until August, his history shows that he was uncooperative, so it wouldn't have helped.
So you are using it as an excuse.
I'm not using it as an excuse by itself, but it's part of the overall circumstances.
That sounds like a no prejudice argument, in a way. Since he wasn't cooperating, they couldn't have done anything if they had shown up. Well, let me just make clear. Your first argument is that appellant carries the burden of proof, and he hasn't established it here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
For the abuse of discretion.
Correct.
Your next argument is that he was not cooperative, although it's not entirely clear how that relates to the regulation. What are your other TikToks?
My second argument as a whole is that the circumstances of his treatment showed that the confinement officials did not abuse their discretion when they were trying to treat him and come up with a proper diagnosis for him. A part of that argument is the fact that he was uncooperative. Another part of that argument
is his prior... But the abuse of discretion is not the treatment, it's the appropriateness of continued review, of continued suicide watch.
Correct. But the appropriateness of that continued suicide watch is based on his treatment.
Was he on meds?
He was.
And who prescribed the meds?
I believe the government mental health providers.
Dr. Leckie?
That's correct.
And which burden of proof, his interaction, I'm just making sure I have your menu, sorry.
His
interaction with the doctors, what's the rest of your argument as to abuse or no abuse of discretion?
His interaction with the doctors, certainly his nature with them, and like I said, the past with him in terms of the reason that he's in pretrial confinement, and then the continued issues he's had once he was in pretrial confinement, which included, and I can see that my time has gone over.
You can continue answering that question. I've got one more for you.
Yes, sir. His continued issues that he had once he was in pretrial confinement, in terms of his accusations that the confinement officials were out to get him, the inmates were out to get him, the voices he was hearing, all of these, to go along with, everything else in the case and his history, is why, the treatment and the status that the confinement officials put him in, they didn't abuse their discretion in putting him in that.
But isn't the stronger your argument for putting him on suicide watch and the odder he acts, isn't that an argument for the more important it is to have daily review of his case to make sure he's not headed in an...
Not necessarily. Just because he's on... The reason he's continued on suicide watch is because of the difficulties they are having in attempting to treat and come to a proper diagnosis on him.
I see. So the stronger the case for suicide watch, the more certain you can be that you wouldn't be taking him off of it after every 24 hours.
That's correct. And it's interesting that in the appellant's brief, they cite to a few 11th Circuit cases talking about the gross incompetence of the mental health professionals in those cases, one of which was when someone was suicidal and they ended up killing themselves. In those cases, the families actually sued the prison system, saying he didn't do a good enough job watching out. So in that case, those cases are basically saying, they didn't do enough. Here, the appellant is complaining that they did too much and that they were being overly cautious for him.
Counsel, in response to my earlier questions, you emphasized the difference between ADCOC and the a review for a violation of Article 13. In the remand of this case to the Court of Criminal Appeals, what in particular was the Court of Criminal Appeals asked to focus on?
It was the focus on in light of U.S. v. ADCOC.
And ADCOC's a 305 decision, not an Article 13 decision?
That's correct.
And where in the opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals does it address 305? Other than simply saying that the issues raised by the appellant are without merit, I see a nice discussion of Article 13 on page 6 of the slip opinion, but I didn't notice any discussion of 305 or ADCOC in their opinion. But perhaps I've missed it.
Be looking on page 27 of the Joint Appendix, where it talks about credit for AFI 31205 violation. Court cites the ADCOC and finds that the medical personnel were attempting to provide confinement officials with the necessary information for them to make a decision on whether to maintain the appellant on suicide watch. They found that his findings of fact and conclusions of law were not clearly erroneous, and his conclusions of law were correct. And that any further award of pretrial confinement credit was unnecessary.
So we're just going to rely on the findings of facts and conclusion of law of the judge below as opposed to any independent determination by the Court of Criminal Appeals as to the nature of the violation of the regulation and its relationship to 305K. In other words, I'm trying to figure out from this analysis that they have how they are analyzing Adcock in this opinion. This looks to me to be very similar to what they've said before with respect to the rule violation.
Well, my response to that is they are analyzing it, they've got the paragraph speaking of and quoting the language from Adcock and saying when we're looking at, and they actually state, quote, while he noted technical noncompliance with AFI 31205, the military judge found that the medical personnel were attempting to provide combatant officials with appropriate information. So the argument would be that they addressed it, while they certainly didn't expound on it, based on his reasonings under 305, under 31205, which, had already been done extensively at trial by the military judge, looking at how the military judge addressed those issues, that was why further credit was not warranted under 305K.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Counsel, the government admits that the instruction wasn't followed. But they, if I understand their position correctly, they're saying that that doesn't mandate any credit. It's within the military judge's sound discretion. And credit was awarded. And so if that was within the military judge's discretion, what are we to do?
That is correct, that it is within the military judge's discretion, but it's certainly on review, looking at the findings of fact and the conclusions of law and the different review at this court. But
I guess where did the military judge get it wrong, other than not giving enough credit, in your view?
The military judge, just like the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals opinion, is absent of any discussion of an analysis under 305K, which brings us back to the forfeiture or waiver. Waiver does not apply in this case at all. In United States versus Chapa, this court held that waiver applied where the trial counsel did not specifically, substantively, implicitly request any post-trial relief or any pretrial confinement relief. Also under United States versus Crocker, we're dealing with post-trial submissions, and there wasn't a developed record. In this case, we have a developed record in terms of what the findings of fact are, what the underlying problems were, they were litigated pre-trial. So I think it's important to note at the abuse of discretion, we're talking about the abuse of discretion of the judge to review the abuse of discretion of the confinement officials. And then in looking at Chapter 8 of the AFI 31205, it states, a medical authority will review the appropriateness of continued suicide watch at a minimum every 24 hours after the initiation of segregation. It doesn't say may.
Well, no, they admit they didn't do that. We're beyond that now.
In the military judge's discussion, he talks about whether the medical providers attempt to provide information but are not provided the information to make an informed decision, and that's not what the regulations say.
But you don't disagree that the military judge awarded credit at all because of the failure to follow the Air Force instruction?
No, it seems that he did award credit
for failure to follow the Air Force instruction.
Yes.
And that's what you base the 305K allegation on.
Yes, Your Honor.
So whatever it's called, didn't he give credit? And isn't your quibble with how much credit he gave? And this is what I asked you at the beginning.
He did give credit based on in his discussion, the finding that there was no intent to punish and that the conditions were not more onerous than to allow a appellant to appear at trial. But he did not. 305K says additional pretrial confinement credit can be given when there are unusually harsh circumstances, and the unusually harsh circumstances in this case is the medical treatment that was woefully inadequate from the defense expert's opinion, and then the deliberate, knowing and deliberate violations of the AFI.
And counsel, to get back to my question earlier, did the Court of Criminal Appeals address that particular issue in its discussion of the 302, in its discussion of 305?
No, Your Honor. The counsel also, counsel for the government also talked about the suicidal ideations and the history. Let's talk about the history of this case. It's five times the mental health provider, same mental health provider that put this appellant into the suicide watch. He can see him five times over a 272 period of time.
It says medical authority.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it doesn't have to be the same person, does it?
I see my time has expired.
You can answer the question. I believe Judge Stuckey had a question as well.
Yes, Your Honor. It's an empty regulation if you allow a medical authority to come in and make recommendations where the mental health provider is the provider that's actually put the individual in suicide watch. So if the mental health provider is the one that puts them in this rigorous confinement facility without, you know, anything else except for a Bible and wearing a gown and a smaller cell and 24-hour lighting for 274 days.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
I forego any further questions.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, there are violations of RCM 305K in that the conditions were unusually harsh and the confinement officials knowingly and deliberately violated the AFI regulations. And for those purposes and for those reasons, in light of the harsh and oppressive conditions of the suicide watch and the government's failure to address alternatives, we're asking the court to find additional confinement credit in the amount of 370 days.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you.